Coming up on this episode of the Leadership Lounge.
The best CEOs that I have met really are very self-aware, self-aware to a fault. They know where they're strong, and they try to limit themselves to areas of strength and then surround themselves with really great people.
My name is Mitch Slater, Executive Director, UBS New York City, and I'm joined by my colleague Saman Sami, Account Vice President, Wealth Management from Dallas, Texas. And the best way to contact us is by emailing mitch.slater@ubs.com or saman.sami@ubs.com. Our guest today, Sean McGinnis, is not affiliated with UBS. That was the voice of Sean McGinnis. Welcome to the Leadership Lounge with Mitch Slater and Saman Sami, brought to you by UBS. This is the podcast where the world's top business leaders pull back the curtain on their journey to success, from the highs and lows of entrepreneurship to transformative insights on leadership and growth. We dive deep into the stories that inspire, educate, and challenge the way we think about business. Sit back, relax, and step into the Leadership Lounge, where great leaders share their secrets. And in today's episode, we had the pleasure to sit down with Sean McGinnis, entrepreneur, former president and chief operating officer for YPO globally, and current member of the executive team at Tiger 21. I know you're going to enjoy this episode.
All right, Sean, thank you so much for doing the podcast with us today. I've had the privilege to get to know you over the years. You've become a very important person to me personally and for business. I feel like every time we spend time together, we always stir things up and laugh and have an actionable step to come back to. But you've become a mentor of mine. But can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and your background? Because you have such a unique story and such an impressive background.
Thank you, Sami, and thank you, Mitch. Great to be with you today. You know, it's an interesting question to start out with because, you know, I feel that I'm only sort of just scratching the surface of life. You know, I'm 60 years old now, just turned 60 a week ago, and I still learn every day, and I still think that I've got a tremendous amount left to do. Intellectually and realistically, I know that that's the case. So I grew up in South Africa, born and raised, and, you know, had a really interesting life. The age of 8, after my parents got divorced to each other and remarried 3 times, I got shipped off to boarding school. That was an interesting experience because it had 2 sides of a coin, the light side, which was great camaraderie, an amazing class group, incredible people that I'm still in touch with today, including my best friend from those years. And then the dark side of that was sort of being thrown to the wolves. And at the time that I went to boarding school, corporal punishment was very prevalent. People would be sued today for the kind of abuse that we received as kids, but you don't really, I was very fortunate that didn't linger. And then I had the good fortune of spending a couple of years in the military, going to university, working for a top entrepreneur in South Africa, immigrating to Canada, spent 9 years there, meeting my wife who's American, and then relocating to the United States. And I've been here in the U.S. for the last 26 years. And most of my formative career, my entrepreneurial career and my growth has occurred in this great country. And I say this great country because even though, you know, we're part of the world, there is something very unique and special about the opportunities that are given to people, whether you're born here, whether you come here, it's an extraordinary place. So I feel, in the context of what I've just shared with you, extraordinarily blessed, and have had a myriad of experiences, both personally and in business. And I will share with your audience as well that something I realized early on in my career and in my life, and it gets reemphasized every day, is that life is messy. And it's how we approach that messiness that gives you an opportunity to either succeed or fail. So sorry for the long-winded entree.
No, but that actually is a perfect segue. I follow your LinkedIn posts. On LinkedIn, I've been, you know, involved with LinkedIn and many LinkedIn employees for many years. So I take it very seriously. And I love when people really put things out there. So I'm, you know, first of all, it is nice to meet you, and thank you for being on Leadership Lounge. And I have a question I'm going to ask you, but I really had to just jump right to this quote, which, you know, you attributed to someone else, but talked about today. The path to being truly interesting is to be interested in others and their stories.
Yes.
Be interested to be interesting. What does that mean to you? And from your experience, you know, as being the global president and the COO of YPO, tie that in a little bit, because that hit home for me big time, that quote. I was really touched by it.
Yeah, and it's something that I come back to constantly. It was something that I learned, I think, from my mom back in the days where she was a real estate agent, and she would do open days on weekends. And because she was a single parent, she dragged my sister, my brother, and I along. And we had a list of questions. We were not allowed to pitch. We were not allowed to sell. It would have been illegal. But she was really smart. So she had three little helpers. And, you know, when the house was crowded, when there were a lot of people, she could only be present with one potential buyer at a time. The three of us would take people on tours. And what we would do is ask a couple of questions. You know, what about this house is of interest to you? What is your goal for the house that you want to, that you dreamed about? And my mom just gave us two or three very simple questions. And it was remarkable, Mitch, what came back from that. One, there was an instant sort of leaning in, and we were kids, right? Teenagers. Mm-hmm. But there was an instant, wow, I've got a teenager that's taking the time to ask me a question. And, you know, then we would regroup as a family afterwards, and we'll share with my mother some of those thought tracks. And she was a top saleswoman, you know, for a number of different very successful companies. And that lesson stuck with me. And in my career, when I've deviated from the power of questions and I've tried to go it alone, or I think I know something, or I'm right, I think I'm right, I always, not fail, but I catch myself, or there are negative outcomes. When I position, wherever I am, the question or curiosity of getting to know people, I always have much more enriching conversations and relationships. So think of it in the context of YPO and EO and these organizations, right, where you have very successful CEOs. What I find is that a lot of successful CEOs don't give themselves permission to be vulnerable, to show that they're openly curious, because they look to, for the most part, by the people in their organizations, their vendors, for confidence. And so there's almost a paradox there, if you would. Mm. So for me, I try every day to learn something about somebody before I insert my views, my worldview, or my experiences. Not that my worldview and my experiences aren't important. They are to me. But in terms of creating that relationship, I find that open curiosity is vital. And it's not just being curious, it's being genuinely curious.
Yes, genuine. That's a key word. And it's so interesting. You used one of my favorite words, which is relationships. I don't know if you've ever read Ted Rubin's book, Return on Relationship. I had him on my show a number of times, and I've become friends with Ted. And I just love that expression. And it's something that I talk to folks in our industry about all the time when they bring up the ROI. I'm like, okay, but what's the ROR? Talk to me about the relationship. What do you know about those people? All right. What do you know about their background, their families, their children, their faith, whatever it is, the things that really matter to them in life. And I, you know, I just love that. And that to, you know, says so much. And in tying in with YPO though, I'd like to hear maybe your thoughts on some of the top three or so skills of an effective CEO and leader. Because you've obviously worked with so many, you know, top folks there.
You know, I think for me, and this is a generalization, because not every leader comes at things the same way, but in my experience, there have been, I would say, four or five things that I would say are anchor skills or competencies. Some of them, by the way, don't come naturally as strengths to the CEOs that I work with. The best CEOs that I have met really are very self-aware to a fault. They know where they're strong, and they try to limit themselves to areas of strength and then surround themselves with really great people. But I think there's sort of five pillars, if you would, of what I would, in my experience, see being the characteristics of success for CEOs. Creating strategic clarity and purpose for their businesses is number one. If a CEO or leader, whether you're an entrepreneur, whether you're a hired gun, whether you're a generation two or generation three in your business, your ability to connect whatever it is that you're doing to a larger purpose, to a clear strategy is vital. So storytelling becomes important. Utilizing factual, experience-based, stories to connect your stakeholders, your employees to that vision is key. The second one, and these are not in priority order, but governance is very important. Setting standards of governance right from day one, making sure that there is continual improvement, there's integrity, there's safety, there's adherence to the legal ramifications and the governance criteria for your business. I call it standards. It's that ethical standard. I operated and visited a lot of countries where, and I just spent 2 weeks in India, for example, which is an extraordinary country. And what they're struggling with in business is managing what has been in the past, some, I would say, systemic corruption. Mexico faces the same, emerging market countries face the same. But if you're as a business person, we're sitting with a very successful business person at dinner 2 Sundays ago. If you do the right thing within the rules of the game, you will be successful and you'll be able to look yourself in the mirror. So that governance, staff, and standards. The third one is structures and process. If you don't have good structure, if you don't have clearly articulated roles and responsibilities, clarity on who's doing what, who's responsible for what, how do you report, how do you do your financial controls, that structure and process is vital. A lot of people, and particularly entrepreneurs, start out their businesses in that growth phase where they don't have an operating system like a scaling up or a make big happen that our friends at CEO Coaching use, or an EOS, the entrepreneurial operating system that Gino Wickman developed. Those systems allow for a number of different important structural and process things to happen, and then the rhythm within those structures and processes are vitally important. The fourth one is keeping score. We spoke about, if you're a sports fan, for example, there is no sport that doesn't have a scoreboard. And so,
Right.
how do you run a business without a scoreboard? How do you measure yourself without a scoreboard? How do you take an external point of view? How do you assess whether your customers will come back to buy from you? That's why NPS is so important. And then making sure that your goals and your measurements are accurate, they're smart, that you're prepared to pivot. And then the final one is the most difficult, I think, for any leadership, for any leader in a business, is how do you align people? Because the most important lesson I learned very early on, I learned it in team sports as a young kid at school. I learned it leading a section in the military. I've learned it being led and leading in business, leading other leaders in the YPO context, is how do you create alignment? And Peter Drucker, is one of the, I think,
Sure.
probably the most well-written, well-researched management leader. He has a saying that basically says the task of leadership is to create alignment of strengths, making a system's weaknesses irrelevant. So how do you do that as a leader? How do
Right.
you align your shareholders, your customers, your employees, your lenders, your community, your regulatory body, managing expectations, salaries, all those things, and then emotion? Because when leaders come to the table, they come with themselves. When leaders pretend to be a leader, it ends up, they end up hitting the glass ceiling. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And when you talk,
Absolutely.
when you talk about the scorecard, you know, which is so true in any sport, and in business, none of that happens right without a playbook. So it even ties in further, because unless you've got your playbook that you're going to work from, then what's the point, you know, as a scorecard? I know Sammy can relate to that as a former professional tennis player. You know, that it you know, for if it, you know, 40 love means something very important to you, Sammy, right?
Yeah.
Right. And I want to piggyback on that, because I remember in my playing days, you know, for instance, in tennis, everyone knows to pick on the backhand side. It's just a common thing that you do. And there were times where I knew it was going to happen, but I would do anything and all to avoid facing that backhand. I would run around it. I would, even in practice, sometimes just not want to do it. And I knew it's coming at me in matches. And that's how good they are, right? And so it's the same thing in business. You just have to be honest with yourself and look at the scoreboard and not take it personal. Just go get better, right? So totally relate with that. That's actually one thing I do to myself here at UBS. But and sometimes it could be unhealthy. So there's a healthy balance there with the scorecard. But we can't completely avoid it, because that's just not smart. The competitor is going to be knocking on your door.
At the end of every game, you know, you've got the fourth quarter. So then you've got the exit planning and how a business owner is going to deal with the exit planning strategy, which is, you know, is something at UBS we take pride in. Sammy's one of our folks that does an excellent job in working with companies that are dealing with exit planning. In your role at YPO, how did that fit in? You know, where did you... How did you help people and maybe some best practices that you learned over the years there?
Thank you for that question. And it's something that a lot of, you know, most entrepreneurs at some point, even if you're building a business to last and, you know, you're building a multi-decade business, you know, my experience at YPO, you know, one, they have a very active series of business networks. And in fact, they have a really strong group that helps members think about and focus on, you know, exit readiness. You know, when are you ready to exit? And I have seen, and I've also led several exits, had my own, and also for a, you know, for some individuals participated in being their wingman, if you would, or their concierge for helping them through the entire exit process. But I always start by asking people when the exit question comes up, is, you know, is your business ready to sell? And are you building your business? I have a friend who's like so anti the exit conversation. And I always say to myself, why is that? And I try and reframe it to the sense of, say something happened to you and I, Mitch and Sammy. Mm-hmm. We're driving home today. You know, I've got a 20-year-old business. I haven't really focused on succession. It's good, but I'm the key driver, everything rolls up to me, and I get run over by a bus. Is my business going to be sellable to the point where somebody can extract enterprise value? I'm working for my family, I'm working for legacy, I'm working so that, you know, my kids can have and my grandkids. I think it's vitally important, particularly when you're through the growth phase of a business. You don't necessarily have to start thinking about it day one. I advocate for any entrepreneur to start building their business with the building blocks and the foundations that will make for successful enterprise value. Successful enterprise value means that you have a saleable asset. When I'm running a business, why don't I get advice from people that have sold a business? Or in the business of selling businesses, I look at it the same way. So I think of selling a business, the strategy of selling a business is like a wheel, you know. Do you have all of these slices of the pie sufficiently well developed so that you can go out to market and get a great valuation and a return for the amount of time that you've invested and money and effort, and et cetera, in your business? And there are about, we may not have time today to go into it, but I have 16 core strategies for helping companies increase their exit value. And there's a lot written about it. There are a lot of great books out there. But it becomes very, very important for somebody that is building a business to make sure that in all those 16 areas that they can check certain boxes. And it also helps identify where the gaps are. You may have in 9 or 12 or 13 of the 16 handled. But unless you have certain, in certain businesses, a verifiable recurring revenue stream, you're not going to get the value. I'm using one example. If you don't, if you don't have a customer base that comes back to you on a regular basis, tells you how good you are, you're measuring it, you're scoreboarding it, and they say, you know, I'm expanding my loyalty. I love you, and they do that in a variety of different ways, not only by writing you a check every month, but they tell people about it and they celebrate you without you having to do it. You know, so there are those levers, those drivers. And if you can build that from the beginning and you can then build that into your scorecarding, I like to say to individuals in that scale exit phase of their business, are you scorecarding effectively your enterprise value drivers that are going to give you a multiple on what you think your business is worth? And put it in practical terms.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting topic. You know, we deal with a lot of entrepreneurs at UBS, and we certainly know our deepest challenges, but I'm actually very curious to hear, in your long, amazing career dealing with all these entrepreneurs, what is one of the two of the most biggest mistakes or challenges you've seen in exits? Because let's face it, most of them go south. It's very hard to execute on. And a lot of businesses go out of business during that process. So what are some of the challenges you've seen?
So, you know, I think it's, I like to say it's getting prepared early. You know, a lot of people go into the exit process not even realizing what due diligence is going to be done on their company. They think they've got the most beautiful child in the world with rosy cheeks. They've done very well in their industry. They're maybe a leader. They may be number one, two, three in their category. They've been told how wonderful it is. The investment bankers sometimes will oversell their ability to sell a company. The good ones don't, but there are some people that will oversell. So it's, are you prepared for due diligence? That is, all your key financial, operational, and legal metrics. I find that that is the biggest gap. I find a lot of people, particularly entrepreneurs, have commingled the way that they run their company with their private allocations. Now, you know, that's fine. You own the company, you're 100% shareholder, you may be offsetting various things, but when you go to market, you're going to have hopefully a reputable accounting firm do a quality of earnings analysis and a deep dive due diligence. And emotionally, physically, and from a practical standpoint, you need to be prepared for that. So getting a data room early, getting into the habits. I would start out by going and spending time with an M&A attorney or somebody that's leading M&A transactions and saying, what are the biggest pitfalls? And the biggest one is the longest tentpole in selling a company is getting ready for due diligence.
Right.
The second most important thing is the people component. If you don't have the right people in the right seats, if you don't have a clear succession, if you as the seller don't know what you're going to do post-sale, you better get on that quickly, because your company is not going to survive with you in absence. I mean, I'm saying this generically, but you've got to have a clear succession that you can show the market that without you and maybe one or two other key employees, the business will still have value. So that's vitally important. It's also important that there's clear, transparent communication in the sales process. When your key employees find out a month before the transaction that you're selling the firm, you've got to ask yourself, what risk does that expose the transaction to? A lot of transactions fail because there isn't alignment of the people that are staying to the sale in the first place. Who's the new owner going to be? Are they going to live up to the agreements, written and non-written? So many things that happen in a business are what I call non-written, or they're not memorialized commitments, but they're there. People have accepted them. It's based on trust. There's a handshake. And so if you're not articulating what those are, you're going to run the risk of losing some very, very important people. So your talent, your human capital, Those are vitally important. And then I would also say your brand. You know, if I look at UBS and how UBS has migrated, and Sammy, you know this, and Mitch, I've spent a lot of years sort of on the inside as a strategic partner with UBS. When UBS came out with their brand commitment, which is, you know, in today's world, what differentiates a bank like UBS and how do we articulate that? And I've spent time with your marketing team in Zurich, for example, and they think deeply about this. Mm-hmm. It's not just lip service. It's not buying some ad campaign from somebody that's selling a Super Bowl ticket, or we're going to increase the number of you know, avocados we sell this year. Very important for the people selling avocados. But, you know, we're selling something. Avocados are a commodity. They're a sustainable, you know, replicable economy. But you're in a business. How do you differentiate yourself? And then the fourth one, Sammy, is IP protection. Knowing what your IP is, you know, and if you can define, develop, nurture, protect your intellectual property, that has value.
I love this conversation because it's like entrepreneurs listening to this, getting 30 years of experience through someone that's seen so much.
In a masterclass.
It really is amazing. So, yeah. You know, but I do like the idea that you bring up about interviewing professionals. I mean, the business owners are typically curious people, but when it comes to this topic, it might be an emotional thing for them. They don't know what's going to come next, so they just avoid it. But I think, why not get a state of the M&A market in your landscape, in your industry, right? Every quarter. It doesn't hurt anything, right? You don't have to make any commitments. Yeah.
And my advice to entrepreneurs and business people at any phase of the business life cycle is get real-time advice. You know, Ray Dalio is an amazing investor, right? You don't go to people that don't know what they're talking about. You know, I'm not going to sit down with somebody that hasn't done what you two guys have done and what you've accomplished in the financial realm. If I'm looking to invest in a fish farm in Patagonia, and you may have fish farm in Patagonia experience, but I'm just making this up, and it's highly unlikely that you're going to be able to give me the real-time core advice, the do's and don'ts. So again, another friend of mine, Dan Sullivan, who started an amazing coaching business. He'd be a great person for your podcast, by the way. He's got a book called Who Not How. The how, we can all figure out the how. There are very smart people that we can hire in business to help us figure out the how. How should I, you know, build my next widget? How should I go to market on this strand? There are books that have been written about the how. But where does the rubber hit the road? It's the who. Who's going to help us get there?
Right.
Who's going to light us up? We spoke about Springsteen earlier. Who did we put on the radio in the morning when we get up, or we go to bed at night or middle of the day, to give us that boost, to give us that psychic income that we need? It's the who. And so my big lesson is, in all of this, and I've made the mistakes too, where I thought I had the answers. And in hindsight, if I'd only picked up the phone and asked one person who had that domain expertise in real time, it would have sold me a world of hurt, a lot of money, a lot of agitator. And this is where I encourage all of your listeners that are in the entrepreneurial journey, who are thinking about selling a business, who are investing their wealth, is take the time to find individuals you trust, because trust is very important, who have credibility, but who have real-time verifiable domain expertise that can mentor you, help you. But you said something really early. You ask somebody to help, or you ask them a question, you're curious, what do you think they're going to do? They're going to give you everything they have, selflessly.
Right, right.
So true.
It's gold what you're telling us today, Sean. Thank you so much. I want you to have the opportunity to speak a little bit about what you currently do.
Yes.
You know, so I love your career because you've been an entrepreneur. Like myself, you're not from this country. I can totally echo that sentiment about the United States. So your journey has been entrepreneurial on the personal side. You've been an entrepreneur. You have seen from all the way from startup to exit. And now with your current role at Tiger 21, you're dealing with folks that did have the exit, that don't know what next phase of life is. So can you tell us a little bit about Tiger 21? in your role there now?
So, you know, there's something out there called a peer network or a mastermind group. You guys all know these, right? So YPO, Vista, the sort of granddaddies. You've got EO, the Entrepreneurs Organization. And Tiger 21 is sort of what I would refer to as almost the pinnacle of the peer-to-peer mastermind framework or groupings. And why I say that is because I've had 33 years of domain expertise. You know, I joined EO in 1992 when we had less than 1,000 members. I was a founding member of the Toronto chapter. I evolved to be the president of the whole group, helped a group of people get it to 5,000 nights, 18,000. I joined YPO on the management team when we had 13,000 members. After 8 years, when I left, we had 33,000. What Tiger does very, very well is it recognizes some fundamentals about somebody that's had an exit and for the first time has significant wealth. And with significant wealth comes responsibility. You know, most Tiger members are concerned with preservation and impact. So how do I preserve and obviously grow if that's their mindset? But how do I now have an impact? And where do I go? Which it's very lonely. So think about the loneliness of when you're building a business and you're a successful entrepreneur and you've got your people and your staff and your meaning and everything is tied up into your business and your identity as a phenomenal business person. Suddenly you sell your business, you end up with a bucket of money. Now you probably had an advisor, but you really haven't been responsible for your financial well-being. Now the pendulum has shifted. You are now responsible for not only preserving that, growing it, but how do you treat it? How do you treat your family? How do you treat your trust structure? So Tiger was created by Michael Sonnenfeld, who's brilliant, by the way, a New York real estate businessman, self-made, who you know had been a member of Vistage, and who by self-admission was not a particularly sophisticated or in fact successful investor on the private investment side. And he gathered a group of people for lunch, had it professionally facilitated, and learned from other people that had had an exit. And that evolved into today, what I would consider to be one of the most beneficial private, highly curated, and very, very, very confidential personal board of directors model. So think of Tiger as your personal board of directors and your other directors of individuals who have a similar wealth or who've had a similar exit structure. And the purpose of the group is not to pat each other on the back and give high fives. The purpose in the group is to come to that group with curiosity, with a desire to learn from other individuals who may have gone down a similar path or maybe, you know, finding things out, who have made mistakes or who are struggling with issues like we all do. And so the structure of the Tiger experience is very powerful. The meetings are facilitated professionally by a trained, very successful, either ex-business person or advisor. There's no selling, there's no solicitation, there's no product. It's all about candid conversations, well-managed and curated. So think of it as, you know, the Tiger chairs, we call them, the individuals that facilitate the groups are like the conductor of an orchestra. They're facilitating conversations. There's also a very powerful construct called a portfolio defense, where it's transformative. Members basically gain insight into every other member's investment portfolio, thesis, philosophy, real time. So in every Tiger Group meeting that takes place around the world on any given week, one individual is opening the kimono and sharing with a high degree of planning, foresight, and diligence how they're investing their money. And it is remarkable. I've sat through multiples of these, and I come away. It's an edge-of-your-seat experience, and it's very important. And the distinction here is it's not somebody telling you what to do. It's you sharing and everybody else from their experience asking questions, clarifications, pushing you a little bit. Much like you're defending a thesis for your PhD or your master's, you know, it's designed to kind of get you out of your, you know, sort of regular thinking and tap into, the collective wisdom real time of the group. And lastly, what's unique about Tiger is as a member, I could be sitting in Dallas, Texas, and that's where my group is. But how does that help me understand what's happening in New York or Zurich or Portugal or Singapore or Dubai? Well, as a Tiger member, you have the opportunity. It's called visitation rights. You can go and sit with the same degree of confidentiality and trust because you've all signed legally binding NDAs. You've all been vetted. You've all had your wealth verified. You can sit in a meeting in Singapore with a group of 15 other Tiger members, hear a portfolio defense, hear what the burning issues of the day are, listen to the opportunities, connect on a deeply personal level. I have not seen anything quite like it. Now, there are many other groups, and I love the peer group context, but this is what I call a niche within a niche. It's powerful, guys. It's very powerful.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, that sounds phenomenal. I mean,
what a gift, you know. Because you brought up Springsteen, I'm listening to what you said there, and I'm reminded of one of my favorite lines from No Surrender is he learned more from a 3-minute record than he ever learned in school. And I think you're probably learning more in 3 minutes at a Tiger 21 program than, you know, they could teach you at, you know, Harvard, Wharton, Princeton, Stanford combined.
Yes. And Mitch, it doesn't get stale. And here's what I mean by that. Because you're getting together sort of 10, 11 times a year, and it's facilitated, you've got somebody that's accountable for the experience of every member in the group. So I'm going to go back to one of your pillars at UBS. It's personalized and it's relevant. Those are two of your brand promises. So Tiger's personalized, it's relevant. And that relevance is based on its real time. It's what's happening now. So you don't think in the last 2 months in the US and the groups here, people were talking about what's going to happen, you know, based on the election outcome. How's it going to impact regulations? How's it going to impact inflation? How's it going to impact not only my portfolio, but where I live, how I think, how I operate? By the way, how's it going to impact me personally? So it's not just business and finance. When you join the Tiger Group, you bring your whole life, your whole person, all of your experiences, as does everybody else. And so a lot of times what happens is, even though the cornerstone is this personal board of directors, it's a personal board of directors for your life.
Yeah.
Stuff happens. Life is messy. It's uncomfortable. At times it's devastatingly terrible and dramatic. And so when you come into that group, you recognize, and everybody has an opportunity to say where they're at, you know, how they're feeling. And the chair's responsibility is to prioritize. There may be a whole agenda developed for a particular meeting and somebody has a burning issue. They've had, you know, a spouse die or a child commit suicide, or they have a health issue. Everything gets redirected there on them to help them solve or at least come up with a plan, a blueprint, a strategy, and know that they're embraced in the safe haven. A lot of groups like EO, YPO, Tiger, we call it a safe haven, you know, and it's powerful. And it all is predicated, by the way, on a very simple construct. And that construct is trust. If you don't develop trust, what I love about peer groups, and I'll talk about peer groups more generally now, what I love about peer groups is they are predicated on trust. If it's performative, if it's just for show, if it's somebody just throwing a bunch of stuff on the wall and hoping it sticks, it doesn't work. There have been many peer groups that have been started based on rah, 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 performative, beat the drum. Trust is if you think of trust, you bring a couple of key components to the table and you get found out if you don't operate from a trust perspective. Mm. Think about our lives, right? Think about our businesses. Think about the commitments we make to each other. Credibility. Vitally important. Reliability, showing up. So in the context of these peer groups, if you don't show up, how can you participate? How can you learn? How can you give your experience to somebody else? Adaptability. That's the third one. Adaptability right. is I'm more committed to learning than to being right. We've right. spoken about this a lot today.
That's and enormous. That's enormous.
Yeah. How do I show up? Do I show up authentically when the Tiger Chair coaches one of the members through their portfolio defense presentation, a big portion of it is their lifeline, their story. And what it does is it goes through, what is your own life journey? What have you found difficult? Where have you made mistakes? Where have you succeeded? What have you learned? And they're asked to share that with the group. That's the first thing they do. So they open up a very deep window into their lives. Imagine if we all had these, you know, groups to participate. I'm very blessed. I have an amazing YPO forum that I spend, you know, 5-6 hours with every month. And then the final thing that with trust is, can you suspend your ego, your self-interest? You know, because a lot of, whether it's YPO, Tiger, Vistage, these are very successful people who are used to getting their way, who are used to having whatever they say be the rule. And in the context of these peer groups, and this is where facilitation is important, helping members, particularly at the early stage of their membership, suspend their self-interest, assume positive intent, offer their experiences as support for other people. That's where the true value goes. And then when you see that, people from all different walks of life, the beauty of these groups is that you don't get clusters of the same kind of people. In fact, the best Tiger chairs curate groups of people that are vastly different, because the difference is the learning, not in
Absolutely.
The similarity.
Right. No, it makes a big difference. So I want to wrap this up with a... I kind of borrow it. I never say really steal it from Tim Ferriss, Tribe of Mentors, because it's something I used in a previous show. And I just love hearing the answers. And based on everything you said, I'm really excited to hear your response to what's known as the billboard question. So, Sean, you're granted this giant billboard for a message for the whole world to see. What would it say and why?
Man, that's a great one. I'm not going to use the one you used this morning based on my LinkedIn post, but that's one that I really, really like, which is, you know, be interested to be interesting. I like the Gandhi. Having just been to India, I'm now obsessed with this burgeoning entrepreneur class and how they're making changes. And it's the largest democracy in the world, 1.4 billion people that are in a democracy. I mean, we need to be protecting India like crazy. Anyway, that's for another discussion. But my billboard would be a Gandhi phrase: be the change you want to see in the world.
Love it.
I love that one.
Love it. That's just, that's beautiful. And honestly, I've done 100 episodes of a show and now 3 or 4 of this one. And I'm surprised no one has said that before, because it is just such, there's just such truth there. Sean, thank you so much for being our guest today on Leadership Lounge. Sammy, thank you so much for making the arrangements to have Sean here. If people would like more information, we will, of course, put a lot of links in our show notes. Sean, thank you very much. And Sammy, anything you want to say in closing?
No, thank you, Sean, for sharing your amazing story. We can't wait to continue our relationship with you and hear more success stories. Thank you so much.
And I wish you both well, and thank you for being leaders within UBS and for sharing this so openly. It's been great.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Leadership Lounge with Mitch Slater and Saman Sami, powered by UBS. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation and gained valuable insights to fuel your own success journey. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and share the episode with anyone looking to grow as a leader. And stay tuned for more exclusive stories and strategies from the world's most inspiring business minds. Until next time, keep leading with purpose.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only, and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc., offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review Client Relationship Summary, provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.